Right, so I'm very happy now to announce our second speaker, Dr. Thomas J. Krauss, who's from Regensburg in Bavaria in the south of Germany. He's currently teaching in a German gymnasium there in Regensburg. Thomas has worked on apocryphal Christian fragments and texts, including a book in the series edited by Christopher Tuckett and Andrew Gregory in the Oxford Early Christian Gospel Texts series. He's worked particularly on the Gospel of Peter and also the Apocalypse of Peter. And like our first speaker, Tommy, this isn't Thomas's first trip to Edinburgh either. He tells me that he came over here as an Erasmus exchange student to Sheffield University whilst he was a student studying English literature and linguistics. And he made the trek up to Edinburgh then and had a look around our city. So anyway, this is the first time that he's presented something here for us. So can we all welcome Thomas Krauss to give us a talk on Larry's work on manuscripts.
Sorry about it. Does that work?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. From textual critical methodology to manuscripts as artifacts, I say thank you for giving me the opportunity to laud a man and his work whom I owe very much indeed. In particular, I thank Paul Foster and Helen Born for the invitation and the outstanding organizational work. And of course I say thank you, Larry W. Hurtado. In short, thanks, Larry. Holy moly, that can't be true. I hate to see Hurtado retire, but hopefully that will mean he'll have more time to continue writing. Now it's not Walter Matthau who reacted to Larry's retirement the way he did in the movie Grumpy Old Man, when expressing his astonishment and sometimes his discontent with something. This is taken from a postscript in an email correspondence about a very attractive miniature codex of the Gospels and the Apocalypse from the 13th century and was sent by an American New Testament scholar only a few days ago on the 28th of September 2011. Yes, it is true. Harry W. Hurtado retires, and first of all, there is a bizarre sadness that comes with the term retirement. Somehow, something like being not there anymore, or stopping work for all times, or even vanishing from the surface of the earth. But before I let my thoughts go astray too far and for too long, allow me to dedicate the next few minutes to some preliminary remarks before I will address Larry's contribution to the study of Christian manuscripts. Pondering on the task I have to deal with here brings me to my first interaction with Larry Hurtado's way of doing research, the necessity of being accurate. Once you responded to a discussion on the TC list, which unfortunately is not there anymore, about providing as many collations of manuscripts as soon as possible. I quote from this rather, or considerably long, contribution to the listener. Quote, obviously, anyone is free to spend their efforts and time on whatever one wants. But the prior question, therefore, one does any such work is this. What uses do you want to serve? If you want simply to produce a working and preliminary draft exercise that is quickly done, and therefore is more likely to have errors, and that is intended simply as a basis for others to improve, then okay, I guess. But this would be something that would be unreliable for detailed usage. If the aim is to supply virtually the manuscript itself, then accuracy is the sine qua non. And if the aim is to provide as much of the manuscript data as can be provided in the transcription, then this would include abbreviations, line length, capitalized oversized letters, punctuation. We've got a typing mistake in there, Larry. Marginal marks, corrections, and more. And all this should be accurate too. So, what is unreasonable about this? What aim is served by a less scrupulous care for detail? One could imagine a transcription that is intended only for those who want to examine only textual variants and none of the other sorts of data listed above. But would not this also require as high a standard of accuracy as possible? Unquote. That was on the 21st of July 1999. Half a year earlier, I had received an off-print of Larry's masterful article on Domino Sacro published in the Journal of Biblical Literature in 1998. Promise I will certainly come to talk about the Domino Sacro later on in more detail. Larry had generously sent that off-print to me, a young, at least I suspect me, having been young in those days, PhD candidate who had just handed in his doctoral thesis. That was my first direct contact with Larry Hurtado. But I must return to what he himself said about accuracy and the conclusions I draw from that for the present eulogy. But wait a minute, is eulogy then the correct term anyway? Therefore, it is apt to provide some methodological clarifications about what I'm going to do in the next and remaining somehow 40 minutes or whatever. Terminology and method must be defined in order to be sound and trustworthy at all. I have not traveled from the freshness and darkness of North Bavarian forests to Edinburgh to do what so often is done when somebody retires from office or work. I will not present an eulogy in the sad, well-known form which has become a tradition to praise someone to the skies, even if his life and work has been mediocre. Such speeches are void, insipid, and above all, fraudulent. So one cannot do without delivering speeches like that in some situations in life. Today, however, it's not such a situation, absolutely not. So I will certainly not stick to tradition for tradition's sake, to etiquette because it's an expression of courtesy, and to nice things just because this is a day in which criticism is out of form. According to Diogenes Laertius, we find Cylon of Sparta say, Democritus nil nisi bene, a saying that has become a classic ever since. Its meaning seems to be obvious. Be silent if you cannot report anything positive about a deceased person. Still, there is a second possibility to understand this proverb. You may criticize the deceased, but only in a fair way, as they cannot defend themselves anymore. In legal context, this saying was sometimes turned upside down so that it was not regarded as a crime to defame a deceased person, but usually it conveys the taboo to criticize someone who has just died. But stop, I'm definitely not talking about a deceased person. Retirement has nothing to do with dying, especially not for somebody who will hopefully dedicate even more time now to researching, writing, and publishing about manuscripts and their indisputable and priceless value for studying early Christianity, its people, culture, and textual testimony. Consequently, even the term eulogy seems out of place here, as it connotes that this might become a funeral oration today. On the contrary, my intention is to be frank and honest, according to the motto, what you see is what you get. That means what you hear is my personal, genuine, and even cordial conviction. Thus, I obliterate the term eulogy from this paper and substitute it by encomio. Maybe laudation? Sounds less formal, and I'm here to laud a person in this work. Oh wait, panegyric. That's it. But what exactly is a panegyric? Volume 3 of the Encyclopedia Britannica, or a Dictionary of Arts and Sciences, compiled upon a new plan in which the different sciences and arts are digested into distinct treatises and systems, and the various technical terms, etc. I explained as they occur in the order of the alphabet. Wow, what a title this classical publication once had. Published by a Society of Gentlemen in Scotland, Edinburgh, 1777. Says it all. A panegyric has to be distinguished from a panegyricon, which is the latter, an ecclesiastical book used by the Greek Church containing the panegyrical orations of various authors on the solemnities of Jesus Christ and the saints. So, a panegyricum is not what I have been searching for, but a panegyric is, because it was, quote, anciently made in the public and solemn assemblies of the Greek, of the Greeks, sorry for this, unquote, and represented, quote, an oration in praise of some extraordinary thing, person, or virtue, unquote. By no means do I attempt to compete with Gorgias, Lysias, Isocrates, or Pliny, but do I regard you all as a public and solemn assembly of Greeks. But there arises another problem. In his Dictionnaire de la Langue Française, Émile Littré explains panegyric as follows, translation for the freedictionary.com. Panegyric means more than eulogy. Eulogy, no doubt, includes praise of the person, but it does not exclude a certain criticism or certain blame. Panegyric involves neither blame nor criticism. Unquote. Oops. Without doubt, blaming a person in a panegyric is absolutely out of place. However, am I not allowed to criticize anything at all? Of course, taking criticism and to criticize in the sense most people take for granted, that means as to find fault and make an unfavorable or severe judgment, comment, etc., this should be not the case anyway, nor is it correct overall meaning of Greek krinon. According to the ancient philosophers and critics such as Plato, Socrates, or Epictetus. Then we find for krino, among other meanings and connotations, to make a judgment based on taking various factors into account and to come to a conclusion after a cognitive process. All in all, an appropriate understanding of criticism involves the positive, appreciating and constructive meaning of krino as it is given, for example, in the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, 4th edition from 2009, where we find for criticism, quote, the practice of analyzing, classifying, interpreting, or evaluating literary or other artistic works, unquote, a definition we can easily adopt to compare to the context this panegyric is embedded into today, by prolonging the definition with the addition or research. And here we go. Fine. Then criticism that might be included in panegyric is an expression of respect, appreciation, and esteem, because it implies the practice of analyzing, classifying, interpreting, and evaluating a person's work. In other words, a profound and thoroughgoing discussion has been performed as a basis for such a speech. But now it's high time to seek you into Larry's contribution to the study of Christian manuscripts. A topic that could make me speak for hours, days, or weeks. Not only is the topic itself so fascinating and thrilling, it is Larry's work on specific items and issues that deserves a more in-depth appreciation than I can give today. Nonetheless, I try to do my very best, and what can be better than taking the man to be honored, hic et nunc, as a guide himself. There is a shelf in my office with some of my favorite titles. Among Schubert's Das Buch bei den Griechen, Robert's Manuscript, Society and Belief in Early Christian Egypt, Gamble's Books and Readers in the Early Church, Blank's Das Buch in der Antike, Harry's Ancient Literacy, Cribiore's Gymnastics of the Mind, Wagner's Early Christian Books in Egypt, and others, there is a copy of Larry's The Earliest Christian Artifacts, Manuscripts, and Christian Origins. Its table of contents helps to select the major topics of Larry's work on ancient manuscripts and to structure what still has to come as follows, and this is the structure you'll find on your handout. Two pages. I will first of all present Larry's work on Christians and the Codex, then of course move on to short forms for specific words, the so-called Nomina Sacra, the Stavrogram, and finally, only briefly but with conviction, will come to other scribal features as Larry names them in his book. His articles the metadata of earliest Christian manuscripts in identity and interaction in the ancient Mediterranean, Jewish Christian and others, essays in honor of Stephen G. Wilson, edited by Cook and Harlan from 2007, and his early Christian manuscripts as artifacts, the Jewish and Christian scripture as artifact and canon by Evans and Zacharias in 2009, follow that structure and offer brief, condensed versions of the book, chapters adapted to different contexts and aims. You will find the titles I address and use for my presentation on your handout on the second page of the handout with the image of the papyrus I come to in the very end. Before I address this quadruplet of topics, allow me a last note in order to forge a bridge between classical textual criticism and investigations into manuscripts as archaeological objects or simply as artifacts. Thanks to Tommy Wasserman, we have heard in detail about Lewis Eckert and scrutinizing PhD thesis from 1973 in the published format from 1981. In his preface, as Tommy already has shown us, Larry writes, quote, New Testament textual studies are not now in vogue, and one encounters many anti-scholars today for whom textual criticism is an almost totally unknown field. Unquote. That was in 1981. Whether or not the situation has changed since then, I leave it to you to judge. En vogue, however, will never become a fitting term for the situation of textual criticism, unfortunately. For many scholars, it is still a boring and bone-dry discipline for weirdos who are not creative and witty enough to do proper theology. Albeit classical textual criticism is being the same ever since, there have been considerable developments which also belong to textual criticism as well. Elton J. Yap, for instance, Larry's supervisor, wrote articles about the social cultural background of groups of people in certain places like Oxyrhynchus, so that Parker himself coined the term narrative textual criticism for studies like Epps. Basically, Parker himself defined textual criticism anew by choosing a telling title for his groundbreaking introduction to New Testament textual criticism, which reads, An Introduction to New Testament Manuscripts and the Text. So, first time manuscripts are mentioned in the title of an introduction to New Testament textual criticism. There, Parker addresses certain issues in addition to readings, variants, and the value of specific manuscripts for constructing a critical text of the New Testament. Larry himself has modified the way he writes about manuscripts in general, and Codex Washington and Tonianus in particular. In Volume 1 of the Anchor Bible Dictionary from 1992, he mentions paleographical features such as the description of the scribe's hand, format, ruling, line lengths, and so on. And in the introduction to the Freer Biblical Manuscripts, Fresh Studies of an American Treasure Trove from 2006, he almost compassionately, but at least sympathetically, writes about the Freer Gospel Codex W and some scribal features. So consequently, in 2007, he ends his article, The Metadata of Earliest Christian Manuscripts, as follows, quote, I hope that a growing number of specialists in Christian origins and ancient Judaism will come to take account of manuscripts as artifacts in terms of their value for understanding broader historical questions, unquote. I wish that this hope will come true. But I do already see a growing number of scholars with some theological background working on manuscripts and not only on individual readings and thus respecting manuscripts as artifacts. Christians and the Codex, or the Codex versus the Book Roll. Recently, on the occasion of a conference in Lausanne, Swiss, with the title From Ancient Manuscripts to the Digital Era, David C. Parker unveiled the secret. The scroll is back again, and ultimately winning against the codex. You must just go to certain pages on the internet and you are told to scroll down.
Yeah.
I was so stunned by that I did. Be that as it may, it is still a matter of discussion how and why the codex eventually substituted the book roll as the most represented form of the book in late antiquity. Which role did evolving Christianity play? Was it just by chance and due to certain advantages of the codex over the roll, or was there a clear intention at work? Did Christians invent the codex? It's a tribute to late Steve Jobs that I insist on using the Apple computer. Sorry. Larry observes a conspicuous preference of early Christianity for the codex. Although specific texts are preserved today on rolls, mostly fragments, that means non-canonical or documentary texts, New Testament texts are from codices and none from a previously unused roll from the 2nd or 3rd century. Treatises, homilies, liturgical texts, etc. were also written on rolls or probably are preserved on pieces from rolls. But Christian literary texts, canonical texts from the Old and New Testament, were written on codices only with the exception of epistrophes, we used material. His focus, however, should not be forgotten. Because Larry concentrates on the first three Christian centuries. It is important to keep this in mind. With the help of the Leuven database of ancient books and the data offered by Macquarie University's Project Papyri from the rise of Christianity in Egypt, he draws some conclusions from quantitative data, calculates percentages, and offers pie charts and graphs. I very much respect that way of concluding from the data that is available after all, although personally, I am reluctant to create statistical data for papyri. What we have today is the result of a rather random and geographically focused stratification of findings. Most of our papyri, and here I use the term papyri not solely for the material, but for all kinds of manuscripts or fragments that are dealt with by papyrologists, that means also for parchment, potsherds, osbroca, lead or silver, defixiones, wood, tabule, and so on. Most of these things come from Greco-Roman Egypt. With the denomination Greco-Roman Egypt, time and geography are given. And if we zoom in on Egypt itself, there are certain centers for excavation campaigns with ox syringes and the famous adventurous and documented efforts by Grenfell and Hunt, as we see on the image there, which became very significant for biblical scholars in the aftermath. In addition, the climate played a crucial role in conserving or destroying documents from the past. Whereas the dry and warm climate in Egypt was perfect for papyri to survive in the sand, they rotted away in other places in the world, unless there was some kind of coincidence of several positive conditions at work, like in Vindolanda in the north of England. But the famous letters of soldiers came to us just because they were conserved in a certain background under a layer of clay. Moreover, let's return to Oxyrhynchus and where most of the papyri were found. Anne-Marie Luijendijk has recently stressed the fact that the papyri were unearthed from rubbish heaps. So, when working on Christian papyri from Oxyrhynchus, we should be aware that we are working on something that was deposited by people in former times. Working on rubbish somewhere. Besides, the archaeological site where a fragment was found does not necessarily represent its origin of writing. To cut a long story short, I'm hesitant to put up statistics as I know how problematic they can be on mathematical grounds and against the background of what I've just pointed out in my brief excursus about the findings and preservation of papyri at random and by accidents. Anyhow, as I said before, I respect and take seriously into account deductions from statistics based on a small share of what is left behind for us, because this is all what we have and all we can talk about and investigate into. Everything else would be an argumentum ex silentio, which is rather problematic in archaeology in general, and the study of manuscripts in particular. Probably I'm that reluctant here because I have my experience with discussing the Stan Large papyrus script from Qumran cave 7, the infamous 7Q5, that was promoted to be the earliest surviving Christian manuscript witness ever, and the earliest attestation of the Gospel of Mark. O'Callaghan, and above all, Tide and his supporters tried to put a fence around their thesis by providing statistics and likelihoods, and, of course, by referring to the principle of fallibilism, according to which a thesis must be regarded as correct as long as there is not another more convincing thesis to falsify the first. But this is a very personal matter. My reluctance towards statistical data that must not be valid for Larry's way of working. As long as the data is taken as it is, as an interim state of knowledge on findings and preservation at random and by accident, there should be no methodological problem. For me, the most apt remark is made by Larry himself. Repeatedly he forms phrases like the preference of the Christians for the codex. So he doesn't insist on any theory of the Christians having invented the codex, which is hard to prove somehow. And this is sound and based on what we are really having. I'm not that positive whether Christians made a conscious distinction between canonical texts and apocryphal writings so that they used the role more likely for the latter. I think of Wolfgang Speyer and his impressive work on Büchervernichtung, book destruction, in antiquity and late antiquity, the manifold reasons and conditions for books being destroyed. I also think of the ambiguous observation made after shuffling through the major handbooks of paleography, Seiler, Cavallo-Mela, Turner, and with the two new titles now available, the marvelous Hellenistic Bookends from 2009 by Cavallo-Mela, and the instructive and comprehensive Handbuch der griechischen Paleography from 2010 by Hermann Harauer, and after studying at least some manuscripts and collections that scribes are really individuals who make use of conventions, but also act rather individually. Nevertheless, there are certain conventions that evidently were of more importance or were more obligatory than others. For example, if you think of the form of ancient letter writing, or the way of preparing a page for writing, probably with a ruling done by a professional. Other conventions are followed or not, such as the end of line new and diacritical signs, tremor or diacritics. So we must reckon with a scribe's individual will to follow conventions or not, or even with a scribe not knowing certain conventions, which is something that makes it hard for paleographers to date a literary manuscript on the basis of the forms of letters. Therefore, such dates are automatically regarded as being always open to discussion, and this being interim results. But this is something that might be of interest when it comes to talk about Larry's work on the so-called Nomina Sacra, and also about regularity and irregularity. Nonetheless, recently Giovanni Bassano from Harvard made an interesting suggestion about the preference of a certain form of the book for apocalyptic texts in early Christianity by comparing manuscripts of the Potter Oracle all on the verso of Rome with early papyri of Revelation, that they join a certain feature. But it's a theory at the moment, and I hope he will develop this further. For now, it is important to me that Larry never promotes his thesis about the codex with a claim to absoluteness. He always makes sure that he reflects upon the position of others first extensively, and then argues for his own position. I want to point out that it appears to me that his motivation is not to argue against others, something he did on discussion lists and fora on the internet, where nowadays everybody can publish ideas, thoughts and nonsense, and things to be on the same level thereafter with people who are researchers and who spend their whole lifetime on a specific topic and or item. Yes, I know, Larry, that is a hard fight. That is something which brings about the feeling being Don Quixote, whose destiny was to fight a forlorn fight, because those people will not change their attitudes and will keep on typing in and sending out their crude ideas all over the world, no matter what you say and write against them. No, Larry seems to focus on writing for something. That means for his own position. This is what I like very much. And in addition, I do not find anything absolute in his writing. Though you need good reasons and a very profound knowledge of early Christianity in order to survive in an academic discussion with Larry, but write so. In his chapter on the Codex in Christianity, he also addresses several theories about how the preference for and or the origin of the Codex is to be explained reasonably at all. I spare you with details and the history of research here. But I want to highlight just a few aspects here. Possibly, the shift from role to Codex had already been in work when Christians had to find an appropriate form for their texts. And with texts, I focus on literary texts now. The book form we use today, and the papyrus codices Larry concentrates on, reminds us very much of them, more than the wood codices for exercises and notes do. Has the above advantage over the book roll to take more texts in one copy. So, the letter could be rather long, that means the roll, and of course then being heavy and bulky. According to Eric G. Turner, the codex form is also a matter of experimenting with how to manage quite some pages within a single book by working on quires and formats. Here I quote from Larry's The Metadata of Earliest Christian Manuscripts from 2009. Quote, Christians certainly did not invent the codex, and to be sure, we even have a few examples of the codex used for pagan literary works in the same period. But these pagan works are parchment codices, often so small size, whereas Christians appear to have preferred papyrus codices. Yet Christians do seem to have been particularly active in experimenting with and developing this book form. And later on, after indicating single gathering or single choir and multi-gathering codices, he writes, this suggests to me that in this period, late 2nd and early 3rd century CE, Christians were themselves pioneering in the more serious use of the codex book form. The experimentation with these varieties modes of codex construction would not have been necessary that had the codex already been well developed for book copying. Agreed, as the formulation is cautious and leaves space for interaction. But there must be more reflection on the purpose of the individual Christian codex and socio-cultural features. Did the early Christians really know what was state-of-the-art in book production in those days? Could it be possible that they tried to figure out themselves how to define a certain book form for themselves that might have looked slightly different from what others used? Leaving that aside, probably Larry is right in pointing at the Pauline epistles as the first early candidate to be brought together in a codex, something that could not have been done equally effective in a book roll. I appreciate his criticism of the current strain of argumentation that the codex might then serve as a tool for easy referencing, for convenient quoting, and for a better orientation within a book, something that is rather complicated if we think of a roll. First, think of Jews and the handling of scripture, referencing, quoting, extracting, and so on, but they continued to employ the roll form. Second, how should flipping back and forth in the codex be so easy if we fancy a continuous text without divisions, headlines, striking features within the texts, and so on? This is also what Larry indicates in that context. Somebody must have known the text rather by heart or so in order to find a certain passage easily. What then is the advantage of a codex over a roll that made it so effective for Christians? Portability, but rolls of specific dimensions could also be taken on a trip to another place in a container or so. Handiness, well, only because we are used to the codex book form today does not automatically make it superior for people in antiquity who got used to the roll and might have been convinced of its advantages, whichever these were. Maybe it was the possibility to bring together longer texts and different texts more easily. Maybe it started with the Pauline corpus or some early stage of it. Maybe it has to do with Jews and the pagan world, where rolls were the dominant form for literary texts. But what else would you say about? I will come back to that issue probably when I join with the Nomina Sacra, which I want to address now. I like those black and white photographs with those serious faces in those things. Don't laugh. It was Ludwig Jarvis. It was Ludwig Jarvis, who you see here, and who coined a new denomination in his book Nomina Sacra, Versuch einer Geschichte der christlichen Kürzung, in 1907. He named the short forms of specific words with a horizontal stroke placed over them, Nomina Sacra, holy names. Are they holy names anyway? Or are they purely the product of scribal convention? Somewhat resulting from the tendency to save letters and space and thus an expression of some sort of stenography or even belonging to the development of tachygraphy. I do not present a history of research here either, but try to sum up, especially by relying on Levin's own treatment of the Nomina Sacra in his JBL article. Hence, I recommend that those of you just go to a library, those of you interested in more detail about the history of work in that fascinating field, go to a library and read Jarvis' book. If you can comprehend German properly, it's a rather interesting style he writes in there. Also go to Pabst Nomina Sacra in the Greek papyri of the first 5 centuries from 1959, or look through the lists in José O'Callaghan's Nomina Sacra in Papyrus Grecus from 1970. Also interesting is Black's article, The Hero, Sign, Christogram, and or Starogram, in Apostolic History and the Gospel, Biblical and Historical Essays, presented to F.F. Bruce on his 60th birthday from 1995. Or Gamble's brief basic statements on 5 pages only from 1995. But above all, apart from Levy's own studies, Robert's thoroughgoing but somewhat outdated discussion of the Nomina Sacra in his classic manuscript Society of Belief in Early Christian Egypt from 1979, the Schweich Lectures. Of course, personally I find interesting what in 1910 and later Nachmanson and Rudberg wrote about the shortening of specific words in inscriptions, and on Ostracher and Campbell Bonner in his studies in magical amulets added about short forms on amulets. All in all, theories about this strange way of shortening words and or names fall in 2 categories. A. There is a certain theological implication of holy names, important meaning, then stressing them. Or B. We deal with a scribal convention or feature. Variations occur, after all, especially when it comes to explain the basic meaning, purpose, and origin of these short forms. We also have on the paper for better legibility is that scheme. According to Larry, following the classification by Roberts, Nomina Sacra falls into 3 groups. The first group you have Jesus, Christos, Kyrios, Theos, which are regarded as the oldest terms to be shortened regularly. The second group, this is mixed up in here, Pneuma, Anthropos, Stauros. That means 3 additional terms that appear to be later and less uniformly treated, and 8 more, Pater, Koyos, Soter, Uranos, Israel, David, and Jerusalem, which according to Robertson and Larry were used rather irregularly. Although this system appears to be very conventional and regular, there are other words and names that were abbreviated the same way. Then on a more irregular basis, that means we find Joshua treated as a sacred bird in manuscripts with text of the Septuagint. We must also take into account that the practice of shortening words or names and putting a horizontal stroke over the remaining letters is also performed in Latin, Coptic, Slavonic, and Armenian, as Larry points out. Recently someone told me about Georgian manuscripts with Nomisa Sakura, but I could not verify that claim, as I could not really prove whether there are or there really are such short forms in Ethiopic manuscripts. Larry also presents deviations from that practice, horizontal stroke over the letters of the Nomen Sacrum and the system of holy words mentioned just previously. But all in all, there's a striking consistency in manuscripts with canonical, non-canonical, and even heretic texts, so that we might suspect some sort of standardization at work in the second century. And if we take into consideration that the manuscripts we have today are copies of so-called Vorlagen, even before that, at least there was a development towards standardization at work in those days. I sum up Larry's position there briefly and hopefully appropriately. One, this is a quote from his manuscript book. The Nomina Sacra do not really serve as abbreviations at all. They are not intended to conserve space or labor. They appear more frequently in Christian manuscripts prepared for some formal usage, such as public reading, the Christian equivalent of literary texts, unquote. Two, the horizontal stroke over the letters might have had its origin from the practice to indicate numbers, as is the case of dates and documents, and stands for some sort of isosophy or gematria that has to do with Barnabas 9, verses 7 to 8, which explains the numerical value of Jesus' names and Clement as a second source. They both parallel the suspended form of iota eta, with iota for 10 and eta for 8, and the cross for 300. So then we are having the cross plus Jesus for 318, and then the 318 servants of Abraham representing the cross and Jesus mentioned in Genesis 14:4. 3. The suspended form of iota eta for Jesus is regarded as the oldest form among the Nomina Sacra. 4. The Nomina Sacra represent a visual phenomenon with an iconographic significance. That means they might be the earliest expression of Christianity as visual culture, something which became more clearly discernible later. Come back to one, here the claim about Nomina Sacra not being abbreviations and so on. Well, I do not want to quarrel about the meaning of the word abbreviation, but sensible or not, the Nomina Sacra illustrate a certain way of shortening words, usually. If we look at the table, we see the strategy of suspending a verb, for example, comes after Jesus in the second line, the suspended form with the first two letters of the word and putting a horizontal line above them. And we also see the way of contracting a word, in other words, to leave the first and the last letter and the horizontal line, or the first, the last, and another letter or letters with a horizontal line over them. Nonetheless, it is important to insist once more on the irregularity of some forms, especially of group 3. What is clear and certainly correct is that the motivation for shortening the words or names was definitely not a matter of saving time and space. Imagine a scribe who had to place the horizontal stroke over letters did not save much time, so he did not have to write the word before. In addition, some Nomina Sacra are not really shortened, as the abbreviated form is almost as long as the full word itself. But the same is true for the so-called end-of-line nui. That means a scribe leaves away a nui at the end of a word at the end of a line, and in order to indicate that a nui is missing, places a horizontal stroke above the last remaining letter of the word. Yes, the practice of writing Nomina Sacra is more widespread in manuscripts with biblical texts and in manuscripts with other Christian manuscripts. That's true. Two, isosophism and gematria. The reference to Barnabas 9, 7 to 8 in Clement of Alexandria has had also been made by Roberts in his manuscript Society of Belief in Early Christian Action. But he indicates that the suspended form Iota Eta, before his son's birth, might have been in usage even before the symbolic interpretation was made up. Page 36. I find this very attractive, as there is also, in other places, a good tradition of explaining events from a present tense perspective, as if you have been an eyewitness. So you write about them decades or even centuries later on. This is a strategy to give authority to a special position, person, or belief. Once I was about to plunge into the pool of discussions about the number of the beast, the 666, or the 616, or the 665, as the manuscripts have that. Galileus explains the numerical value, as Tommy has already pointed out, of 666 in his Adversus Heresis, book 5, and he disqualifies the alternatives as well as their supporters as being ignorant and without any knowledge. But in the Monogramma Christi, attributed to Jerome, but probably not from him, there is an argumentation against all kinds of isopsestic explanations of the number of the beast by referring to the secret that is hidden in it, and that should be left in it. Thus we see that isocephy was not undisputed among early Christian scholars. Of course, it depends on the dating of the work, the Monogramma Christi, which is probably late 4th, I think, could also be dated to the 5th century. For Papyrus Oxyrhynchus 4499 with Revelation 1318, a small papyrus fragment which attests 616 as the other number of the beast, there is a nice and even funny excursus on the internet pages of the Oxyrhynchus Papyri online bearing the title Numerology of the Beast. Yes, we know that educated Greeks were fascinated by puzzles and games based on number. Harmonizing the name of the emperor Nero, in Greek Neron, with Omega, with 666 is impossible without some sort of trick or alteration. By experimenting with letters and their numerical value, we might bring together Neron with the value 1005 and Indian Metera Apectane, killed his own mother. So Nero killed his own mother, because both of them had the numerical value of 1005, didn't he? Maybe the Greek letters for 666, hero, he, si, and ro, represent the initials of three words, as Rebel Coase once suggested, more a spontaneous idea than a serious theory. Another funny and quite bizarre play on isosophy is also found on the Oxford pages. If we take, for example, Tony Blair MP, we get the same absolute value as for I'm Tory Plan B. Okay, this is outdated now, and somehow, but I think what they want to make clear on their pages with a funny way of discussing that is not that it did not exist. No, not at all. But that we must be careful not to overdo that calculation. It's so attractive, it's so nice, it's so a good idea. You find so many things. But did people really know that? In those days, that's the whole thing. And we can't ask anybody about this anymore. With this, I do not claim that isosophy was not applied to words and names, and I do not claim that people were totally ignorant of it. But we should be careful not overshoot with our efforts to force a meaning on something. The thesis, hesitatingly provided by Roberts and with some more force by Larry, is sound and logic, though I'm not sure if it applies to the horizontal stroke of the nomina sacra. Larry links the horizontal stroke with the practice of indicating dates in documentary papyri. We have a Greek letter with a stroke above it. And obviously the suspension comes from that practice and originates also from the Jewish Christian tradition of Imagria. That might be right, and is very attractive. However, personally I regard it as being too complicated and refer to the end of line new as an alternative origin in cooperation with other strategies of shortening words, such as putting a dot above the initial and last letter of a shortened word. want to show you because it might be very important, but I cannot really understand how that should go on, idea I come to in a minute. How the stroke also from the back becomes visible when you look on a page or on a portfolio. You see the strokes somewhere above letters. So it's becoming a visual thing. Larry points out this visual material culture here and there. And I think that might be the key for understanding that strategy, also when we come to talk about the styrogram as an iconographic element. This is somehow striking. With this, we might identify a manuscript rather easily without knowing what's in there. And if we zoom in a little bit, maybe the position of a reader who has got that in front of him or her, it's even more easy to see where those important words are, or in other words, where the letters are that might be problematic for understanding that in a row, because the letters read out like that do not represent the complete words. Maybe it's also a warning, highlighting, hey, be careful, here is something. So this idea about iconography, about the visual, material culture of Christianity, this is what fascinates me. There, I think that's something you must go on with. So I skip the next section because this is also a matter of discussing things in detail. Also the story about the inscription with Yota Eta from Syria which got lost, and once I decided with Christoph Marchis, we heard about Lawrence Hurtado to go on an adventure travel to find it somewhere, but that's not the matter today. Another thing I just want to point at is that we also have a very interesting rare use of another suspended form in only two manuscripts. We have the Yota Eta, which is represented rather astonishingly, I would say, in early times. You pointed out the Salian manuscripts very. But we have the He and the Ro sequence in P45, in Acts 16:18, and in P18 for Revelation 1:5, and they follow each other. So of course we can make an easy trick and say, the key row is just meant as an analogy, formed that way that it fits the Yota Eta. Or maybe there's also another explanation for that, and maybe this he and draw with the horizontal stroke also leads to this styrogram discussion, but I can't sense that because I'm not an expert in that. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's just an analogy to other places where we've got that. I also saw, again, P45, which has not yet been adequately considered, where numerical value is written analogously, namely omicron beta with a horizontal stroke above it for hebdomen conta duo. That means for a numerical value there. Right, and let's skip that. I don't want to address the number of the beast again. It's not an easy day. This set comes to number four. The thing about this visualizing items by putting the stroke above them and shortening things. This has already been addressed and leads more or less to answer the question whether the nomina sacra resulted from a theological reflection, highlighting theologically important names according to Jewish practice, but with the difference that the shortened forms in Greek did not indicate that the name should not be pronounced as the Hebrew or Paleo-Hebrew Septuagint did. Or do we just have purely scribal practice without any further meaning or implication? Probably it must be both somewhat. Whether we accept the numerical value for this suspension, or not, does not really matter here. Special words or names were highlighted and so visualized to be seen and identified rather quickly. If you accept Robert's and Larry's categories and their temporal sequence, which I willingly do, we see that the first set, and again, you have it in front of you, the first set with the Theos, Kyrios, Jesus, and Christos, that this set manifests the most salient and straightforward terms at all. Then come more complex and indirect references such as Stauros or Pneuma, and then terms that were only later theologized, if you may say so, but maybe not consciously and just as an analogy to the first two categories. The nomina sacra then also represent the scribal conventional feature, because I do not see a scribe or copyist later on reflecting on the theological implications of the nomen sacrum, but before writing or copying. For most of them, the nomen sacrum would just be there in the model text, the Vorlage, and they took it over or changed it. Of course, that way mistakes happen and words were shortened that were not really belonging to nomina sacra, and so the growing irregularity within and outside the last group could be explained. But allow me to come to the Stavrogra, the aspect that fascinated me most, because I was totally ignorant of its implications. In former times I took it as just so an abbreviation or a form of decorating a nomen sacrum later. I'll come back to this later on, probably, if I find time. Here you find different ways of writing the Christogram and the Stavrogram. First of all, I must say thank you, Larry, for rejecting and falsifying inaccurate, shallow, and very superficial notions with your brilliant study, the Stavrogram in early Christian manuscripts, the earliest visual references to the crucified Jesus in New Testament manuscripts, the texts, and the world from 2006. Other scholars notoriously confuse the Stavrogram with the hero symbol. The first one there, the first two letters of Christos, the iota hi, the initial letters of Jesus Christos, the iota eta, the first two letters of Jesus, which all refer to Jesus and or Christ and are subsumed as Christographs. But our focus is set on an intermingling of Tau and Rho. Tau manifests an early Christian representation of the cross, and Barnabas probably, maybe, and Rho is written onto it in a way that its loop is above the horizontal line of the Tau. Then the combination of Tau and Rho looks as if a human figure is hanging on a cross, the loop representing a head. This sign is present in early papyrus codices from the early 2nd to the mid 3rd centuries, like the famous P75, P66, and P45. The Tau symbol is part of nomina sacra for Greek Stavros and Stavro. Probably the nomen sacrum, including the Tau, was used earlier for Stavros than for Stavro, and thus was earlier established as such. If you just look at the three well-known Christian papyrus codices, it seems appropriate to take a certain trend of standardization of writing nomina sacra with the Tau for granted. We must not forget to accept the scribe's role as that of a copyist who had a model text, a Vorlage, in front of him, so he might even sense that it was even earlier at work. Larry develops first insights into the history of the Stavrogram, especially by Kurt Arland, further, and takes up and supports points made by Erich Dinkler in his Signum Crucis from 1967. It's just natural that the Tau or ligature is to be associated with the terms Stavros and Stavro, or cross, crucified, because it perfectly visualizes these terms, whereas the Christogram has non-Christian equivalents and parallels which might have influenced adoption by Christian circles. There's no such evidence for the Stavrogram. Although the meaning of Tau for cross is backed by Christian authors, Justin Martyr, Tertullian, and undisputed, the question remains what we should do with the Rho. Where does it come from? What does it stand for? Again, Larry refers to Isosifism and consequently finds out via Franz Josef Döger from 1925 that Roh has the numerical value 100 and could stand for good fortune because Ep Agata also amounts to 100. Then there is Ephraim the Syrian who comments on a symbol that might have been the Tarot and he identifies the Roh with Boetia, help, with the numerical value of 100 again. Larry is rather reluctant to accept Döger's suggestion completely. He finds no evidence for a significant position of 100 among 2nd century Christians and their Isosifism. But he also refers to Boetia, help, which should not have been very prominent in Christian vocabulary. But Boetia, help, is often found on very many amulets from later centuries, and it is derived from Septuagint Psalm 90. The story of the first verses of the psalm has already begun in Judaism on grounds of the Hebrew psalm, which was officially determined to ban demons and to protect against evil powers. It can be assumed that the Greek version of the psalm has even been popular with the people in the first 3 centuries CE, so that Boetia, although we do not have much evidence for that, was a rather prominent term among Christians, at least in Asia. Nevertheless, again, I'm not content with a reconstruction of the background for Tarot on the basis of Isosophy. It might be right, but I regard it as unnecessary, as the Roh could easily come in as a pure visual factor to produce the iconographic and telling symbol. And this is also a point I share with Larry. You do not really insist on the Isosophy for the Tarot thing. Not here. You provide us with Döger's view on that, but just for completeness sake. So, and it was a good idea, but very optimistic by Döger. Furthermore, the Roh is part of Stauros, of the word, comes in there, and Stauroo, also it's pronounced in that way, that we have the Roh being heard and being seen in the text, and therefore it comes in easily to form this representation of the crucified Lord. For me, the most salient and apt aspect of Larry's treatment of the Stavrogram is that, as it was the case with the Lumina Sacra, it is taken as a visual representation of the crucifixion. Therefore, the Stavrogram serves as, quote, a pictographic reference to the crucified Jesus, unquote. Then it is, quote, 200 years earlier than what we are commonly regarded as the first visual references to the crucified Jesus, unquote. And here we go. The quotes are from early Christian manuscripts as artifacts. So, quote, the Stavrogram and the Lumina Sacra comprise our earliest physical evidence of Christian efforts to express their piety visually. Maybe we can also add up the codex form, and also add up the Lumina Sacra, all and think about how much they add to the picture of visualizing, of iconography, of recognizing a book as being Christian. I come to a manuscript. We are talking about manuscripts and Deutsche. Okay, I summarize the last page I've got here about Larry's section, Other Scribal Features. And it's right so. Textual critics too often neglect that we have to do with physical objects. And those physical objects also have texts and writing, but they offer other features and other insights into the world of late antiquity, you put it that way. I made a preference for a non-literary text, a letter. This is very fragmentary, but in the original you can read the letters. Yeah. And I also took that on copyright reasons because we can use the Oxyrhynchus images rather easily and show them. Most of them, which are not kept in the Bodleian Library, will fine you for that. I just skipped first of all to the translation, to my dearest lady sister, greetings in the Lord, lend to Israel, since I lent you the little Genesis, farewell God from us. With this, we learn that Christians borrowed or lent books, they exchanged books, or sent them, even sent them. Okay, don't give it to British Mail, but somewhat like that. We also learn that there is a lady sister. It's a woman. With this we can also infer to society, to status, who was in a position to learn to read and write anyway, because it was luxury. An Egyptian farmer, what use would he have of being literate? What for? So it's not the same situation as we have today. So a very, very specific elite was really able to read and write. And we also learn that they do not exchange the Gospel of Mark. They exchange apocryphal texts like Ezra, and the little Genesis is Jubilees. This is what they send to each other. And, of course, we are used to the biblical uncial, the biblical minuscule, but this is real writing because it's the writing from everyday practice. Okay, rather upright letters, but we have ligatures, the positions. That means there was some speed in writing, some experience. So this person knew what probably she, maybe two women, or he did. And with this, we can also sense here, this is so, and over there, and second line in the middle, we can also sense the practice of Nomina Sacra being used in there, of course, 4th century in the form of confections. But in the usual convention, as Larry has pointed out and insisted, right? So that it was a convention also taken. With this, I just want to demonstrate that we need to look at the manuscripts itself and take into the account that they are physical objects. You can also describe the color of that manuscripts, because it can tell something. The quality of papyrus also explains something about the costs and who could afford that, and so on and so on and so on. And with this I totally sign what Larry writes about that, and I totally accept and would promote what he insists on, that we must take into account all kinds of details and information we can draw from those objects. The last point, and a very short one. Larry has done a lot, but with this I do not mean that he produced a quantity of studies. No, he always published quality, accurate quality work. Needless to say that his studies influenced me a lot. I once started working on Nomina Sacra in order to systematize and to categorize this field of research. After beginning with the Tetragrammaton and other forms of shortening the name of God on manuscripts from and outside the Old Testament, I was about to use my collected pieces of information for first article. It was then that I sent an email to Larry asking him for an off-print of his JBL article on Nomina Sacra, and some days later received it with a brief dedication by Larry. All was said and done then. So I did not see a point to write anything about it. I started with a reference to accuracy, and I almost end with how Larry qualifies research and the work of researchers after all, again on the TC list one day in 1999. Quote, I know it's frustrating to find A, what all is involved, and B, how difficult and time-consuming it all is. Good scholarship is simply time-consuming, demanding and difficult. It's why people have to give themselves to it on a career basis. Unquote. Larry W. Hurtado, I hope so much that your career does not come to an end and that it is far from over. One definition of retirement is life after work. That should be a telling definition for you. But do not forget, retired but not tired, or restless retirement, or unrestful retirement, or whatever, and so on. Be that as it may, I sincerely hope that you will find time for research, for writing, and for publishing, for initiating further and grandly projects. Or should I say, I hope very much that you are longing, even craving, for the kind of accurate research for which you have become well acclaimed and respected as a first-class scholar. But it may be necessary to have some spirit. Better to say, to have some Neuma. From the north of here comes this, for you, Skodin is greed. And this pity and biting spirit is exactly the appropriate liquid for the arid and dusty field of textual criticism. And the study of dusty and dirty manuscripts. I owe you much, Larry, and I say thank you very much.